this type of acknowledgement, sometimes referred to as a land acknowledgement or land statement, is something relatively new. It's something that we've been doing at UVic and people have been doing elsewhere in the last couple of years, I guess largely after the 2015 Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as part of a larger awareness of some of the colonial realities of the country we call Canada. To do so is to think about Canada's history in a different way, in a new way. And this is one of the themes of this season's Café Historique. What we're trying to bring to you this season are stories, are great stories. Sometimes these are stories about famous individuals that are retold in a different way. Sometimes these are stories about individuals who have been long neglected, or events, or strange mysteries that have been neglected, or that have the documents relating to them have languished in the archives, almost forgotten. So bringing these stories to light, or telling old stories in new ways, is what we're about this season of Café Historique. And so I'm very pleased today to present our speaker, who is going to be revealing or talking to us about an individual whose story has been largely neglected. The title of the talk is Missing in History, the Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Indigenous Rights Activist James Tate. Our speaker is Wendy Wickwire. She is an emeritus professor at UVic, where she was shared between the Department of History and Environmental Studies. Her main research interests are oral history, Indigenous history, environmental history, and the history of anthropology. She's also developed many innovative courses while she was at UVic, at least in the history department, and one that I remember in particular was a cultural history of salmon, an upper year seminar that her students loved. I know that from firsthand testimony. She's, of course, a prolific author as well. She's produced three books with an Okanagan elder, Harry Robinson: Write It on Your Heart, Nature Power, and Living by Stories, A Journey of Landscape and Memory. She also authored, or co-authored rather, with Michael McGonigal, a book on the Stein River called Stein, The Way of the River, and also co-edited with the same author, Victory Harvest, The Diary of a Canadian in the British Women's Land Army, 1940 to 1944. And she is, of course, the author most recently of the book on which this talk is based, At the Bridge, James Tate and an Anthropology of Belonging, published this year by University of British Columbia Press, copies of which are available at the back after the talk. There's a gentleman sitting at the bar who will be very happy to provide you with a copy of the book. So please join me in welcoming Wendy Wickwire.
Well, thank you, Peter, and thank you, everybody, for coming. And it's wonderful to be part of this very special event that has John Lutz is here tonight, and he's responsible. He's the chair of the History Department, and he's responsible for setting this up, we figure, about 7 years ago. And the themes are always engaging, and it's so lovely that it gets a pretty good turnout. This is the first time I've actually talked at this event. And somehow the topic was perfect for me, the overall theme, great stories. I jumped at that one because I really do think I have a great story about a great man. And the book has just come out, so it's just perfect for that too. So I'm going to start off, first of all, I started off with the cover of the book, but it moves on to, no, I haven't started with the cover of the book. I've started off with an image that really speaks to who this man, James Tate, was. This was in Ottawa in 1916. And as I'm going to be doing throughout this talk, which I try to do in the book, is bring forward the names of those who were part of this story of James Tate, the people who interacted with him, very, very important chiefs, a long line of very interesting, important women. So these were three chiefs, and he worked very hard for them. And I have a neighbor here who, Anne Kittredge, who I tested this manuscript on, and she's here tonight, and she asked me to read one segment. I've been looking like mad for it, but I found another one. And I think the event speaks, perhaps, I hope, to what I tried to do in this book, what this event does, which I think I really praise John so much for, is trying to bring so much of what we do in the academy, which is a lot of teaching and a lot of writing. It tends to be academic writing that goes into journals or that goes into academic books. And some of it doesn't really reach the public. And what I love about this event is it reaches the public. And I tried very hard with this book to reach the public, but without giving up, I hope, my academic substance I had. It's easy, I found, to dump a lot of facts on a page. It's very difficult to write a chapter that will appeal to all readers, not just those who in my area, but to just the general readers. And for me, what was very important was to reach Indigenous readers. And I'll speak to that in a minute. So my neighbor who test read the whole book for me was a big step for me, because I really wanted someone outside of my academic sphere to read this book chapter by chapter and tell me what she, as an honest, she said, I'll be very honest with you, if I don't get through, I'm going to stop. So anyway, I gave her chapter one, fear and trepidation, and then moved on to chapter two. And then she actually said, you know, I think, you know, and I really want to be honest. She told me, I'll stop if I find it hard going. She asked for chapter three. She asked for chapter four. And it was just, I started telling her by about chapter eight what was happening in chapter nine. She said, no, don't tell me. I want to find out myself what happens in the end. So with that, I felt I had achieved something. And she's here tonight. And she'd asked me to read something that she thought was special. I can't find it, believe it or not. There's so many passages here, but I will read you what resonates with the part that she wanted me to read, which was Tate saying that when I'm with these chiefs translating for them, which is what he did, I am very careful. I could push them in any direction that I wanted in a way. None of them spoke English, but I don't want to do that. I really prefer to explain everything I can to them and then have them make their own decision. I don't want to be part of their decision. And that had really moved her. But I also like this one. My friends advised me to have nothing to do when he decided in 1909 that he really was going to go full on into the Indigenous political activist campaign over land. Tate said, wrote, my friends advised me to have nothing to do with helping the Indians, that it was a matter for government officials and others to attend to, that I would get no thanks, that I would be branded as an agitator, that the Indian agents would consider it an interference, and on the whole, so many people would misunderstand me and get down on me, my success in standing in the country would be injured. I mean, it was really something that took a fair bit of courage, but for Tate, it was a no-brainer. That's exactly what he wanted to do. So here I do have the cover of the book. And Bridge is important for lots of reasons, as you'll see as this unfolds, because the story takes place at Spence's Bridge. So the place is still known at Spence's Bridge as the bridge. He was the bridge. But to me, names are really important. I want you to sort of feel at the end of this talk that maybe you know a bit about some of these people. So in this photograph we've got, which was taken in 1904, we have Tate on the left, in buckskin, incidentally, and we have Jamie Wanamkin. I was just so pleased. He was from the Cook's Ferry Band, Spence's Bridge, and they're riding along, and I really like that you can sort of see that they're engaged with one another. It's really important to me throughout this talk to consider that you have someone in 1900 who is totally fluent in their language. We had missionaries who could run services in their languages and speak fairly well. There was one, a Roman Catholic, Father Maurice at Kamloops, who was fairly fluent too. But here we have someone who really could communicate in their language. And I was happy to find Jamie Wanamkin among Tate's many, many lists of names of people. on this list, Wanemkin, Jamie, young man, that was probably around 1893. I'm including this one because for me, the book came out in June, and it's been my dream to get to the communities that are central to this book. And so Michael, who's over in the corner, and I hopped in our car with some books and headed to Merritt, Ashcroft, Lytton, and Spence's Bridge. And we had seven events, six of which were hosted by the Indigenous people. And they were, if nothing else comes of this project, this was it for me. I spoke to high school kids, two high school kids bought books. And people were, this was at the end of the Lytton event where actually the people in that photograph sang an honor song after my book presentation. And I love this one because it's from Ashcroft, and you can actually see how many books people are buying. Some of them were buying three or four books, and the two women on the left had come over to Ashcroft from Lillooet to the talk. So it was a really heartwarming experience. And for all of them in my talks, and what I try to do in the book is I have a long relationship with this community that started with the people in that community in the late 1970s. And it really started with my interest in music and songs. I'm an East Coaster, but I ended up out here with Michael, who said he would never be anywhere else, especially in the summer, ever, than the West Coast. So I had to make a choice. Well, I made it. And I started out in the kitchen. One of my first visits was in the kitchen of Mary Abel. I think I put their names. Whoop. No, I'm going to go back. Mary Abel. With songs. I had been transcribing. In those days, there were no computers, so someone with an ear for music who could put songs down on paper, a crazy exercise. I got a job doing that. And they were songs from up in the Vernon area, Okanagan. And Mary was an amazing singer, and Nellie Gutierrez, she was Okanagan, Nellie Okanagan, and Eva Lawrence. This is Mary, I call it in a way, kitchen table ethnography, because I was going in with old recordings. Some were 60s and 70s recordings at that time, and playing them for Mary, who was singing them. And then I ended up finding this man, James Tate, had recorded songs at Spence's Bridge, over 200 songs between 1912 and 1920. I had and kept detailed notes. So for me, this was a treasure trove, because not only did it open even more doors, because I ended up going back to these communities with the old recordings. You can see here I've got my old reel-to-reel recorder, which was considered a portable thing at that time. And they brought along their cassette recorders. I'm playing old Tate recordings from 1912, 1913. Often I tried to get people that they knew, and then various community members would come in, and it would just be a treasure trove of singing and conversation. I'm playing just a little clip because I have a clip of this particular evening, and you can hear them. Mary's sort of leading the way. And I intervened too, but I want Mary to kind of introduce herself on the tape. And Mary thinks that she should be introducing Tate and these singers. And it's kind of, you'll just see what fun it was, even though I don't think it's going to be very loud. You're not going to hear much, maybe. But
hold it up to the microphone.
Maybe I could.
Well, I guess that's not fun.
I guess I'll unhook everything, so I'll just try. Oh, too bad. Oh, the microphone. But what I want you, hopefully, it was just laughter and singing and all mostly in the Okanagan language. But what I love about the next one is this was in Merritt. And which was a real treat for me, because I've tried to sort of show you those three women. Janice's mother was Eva, and Hilda's mother was Mary, and then Lynn sitting beside Hilda at this event, which was just about 10 days ago. they were all there. I mean, and listening to this, watching the slide and listening to this wonderful, wonderful thing that was going on there. So there they all are again. That was at my book launch, just some of the same people who are all in the communities as well. What I want to show you is that Sharon Spinks, who's in the middle, I've got my arm around her. This is leading to Tate. I've got her in the middle of this photo. So Tate, as you're going to learn through this talk, was just an amazing community guy who knew everybody for miles around from Spence's Bridge. And what you're going to get a sense of is how he died in 1922, but how his legacy, how his recordings and his field notes and so much of the work he does has connection to the communities and the people today. That's what I really, really love about the whole project. It just, and even about the reception to the book, it's about Tate. It's just about what he did there. So there I have a photograph that Tate took in 1913 of a woman named Chaya holding a baby named Hilda. Well, Hilda over in the other photograph on the right was one of those wonderful old singers from Lytton. She was in Tlacatmac. I spent a lot of time with, just a wonderful woman. And Sharon is Hilda's daughter. So in the last one I showed you, Sharon was at the center of the book launch, and she opened the session 10 days ago in Lytton. Very special. But the photographs, you realize this is one of hundreds of photographs that Tate took of people. And you can see what I love about it is she's looking at someone she knows. She's not looking fearful like this photographer is somebody she doesn't know. She's holding this baby, Hilda. But when Hilda saw this photograph, when I took it to her in Lytton, it just broke her up completely because her mother had died and her father in the 1918 flu. She didn't have any photographs of her father. That was a very traumatic thing. So, and Tate recorded her mother singing. I mean, it's just the connections, you know, and Sharon, the daughter, sang a song at the people who were there at the book launch in Sydney. And it's just, it's just this photograph to me says a lot. So this, to get started on Tate's legacy, this is gives you a little sense of the published work. 11 major monographs published between 1898, and he died in 1922, some published until 1930. I've given you some. These are huge pieces of work. You can get most of them online. On basketry on the top one. The major one is over there at the Thompson Indians of British Columbia in 1900. Just a massive ethnography on the Tlacatmac people, 1900. He carried on and did an adjacent group, the Shuswap in 1909, the Lillooet in 1906. Major work, as I say, on basketry, on ethnobotany. These are the published works. Major published works. So this is what got me going on the book, and this is what I hope the book does. In a way, you know, we were toying with, I'm glad that the talk tonight is called Missing in History. My first chapter is called Missing in History, and some people know that I was toying with a title, Missing in History, because it just seems so shocking to me that with a legacy like this, why is it that if we are asked to reflect on the publications on so-called Indians in his time period or just after, we've got a wide, eclectic range of things. We probably, many of us know of Gray Owl and books that sold by the thousands in the 1930s and Longlance, and they were imposters. And I have it in the book, Michael's uncle Mort was from North Bay, was a really new off-the-block journalist for the North Bay Nugget, and he was following Gray Owl around at one stage and actually doing some digging and found that he really wasn't Archie Bellany, he was somebody else, and so started tracking it down, and then he came to North Bay, and Michael's Uncle Mort actually confronted him. Apparently he was with a photographer, they picked up and bowled it out. Mort went to his publisher of the North Bay Nugget and said, I have this story. It's going to be quite a story. And the editor publisher said, you can't do it. You know, it's the height of the Depression. I guess it must have been right around 1929. Grey Owl is such a good feeling story for Canada right now. We just can't let this story out. So poor Mark went with that, and they released the story 3 years later. So these are some of the works that everybody was reading, everybody knew about. The ethnographers, some of the best sellers. For example, Edward Curtis. We all know a fair bit about Edward Curtis, the photographs, the murals at the Royal BC Museum. Marius Barbeau is probably one that everybody will recognize. Marius Barbeau, he's a character in my book. He doesn't come off very well, I'm afraid. The editorial cutting and embellishing and changing that he did of some very important work by Tate and Chief Chetlanitsa is just shocking. So, and he did some, I have questions about Marius Barbeau, and he turns up in the book. So we also have pioneers in anthropology. Franz Boas, who was also a huge name in anthropology, considered the father of anthropology, is in this book. He's on the left. You can see Franz Boas became famous. This was his field site. He did massive amount of work out here. He's probably, you could call him a major theme in my book. I had to try to understand Boas as a man, Boas as an ethnographer, Boas as a scientist. It was a big nut to crack, and I'm not sure I even have, but he is so important for the West Coast. He was based in New York City, but his work came out of this region, a lot of his own ethnographic writing. Edward Sapir, too, Boas's student, and ended up in Ottawa in 1910. We actually had an anthropology department in the Ministry of Mines, Geological Survey of Canada, and he was appointed to that job in 1910. Others, these all figure in my book. They wrote too, and we mostly academic work. We don't know, not a lot of it's in the public. So then you look at my guy, James Tate, kind of a different look. I wanted this image in a way to kind of give a sense of how different the whole persona, the whole what you see even in these images. When he came to Spencer's Bridge, he just launched into the Spencer's Bridge life. It was an outdoor life. And it has its roots here in Shetland. Now, this side of the story, I wanted to understand it, but blocked it out for a long time, but finally had to address it. And when I did address it, it took about 10 years to figure this one out. And it's too much to go into detail here. But has anybody been in the group? Nobody's been. Oh, you must all go. It's an overwhelming experience. It's a life-changing experience. For me, it really explains so much about Tate. As you can see, it's an island. I've put it in the inset. That is closer to Norway than it is to Scotland. So a 12-hour ferry trip from Aberdeen to Lerwick told me a lot. So when he came here, he went to school to age 16, which is quite a long time at that stage. He ended up following an uncle's letter who offered a job at Spencer's Bridge. When he was 19, he left. So it was a long trip. He was from Lerwick, where the red dot is at the bottom. But the family was from the outer island of Fetlar. So Tate's politics came to light for me through this allegiance to his Shetland home, which he never lost, by the way. He really felt, you know, we understand colonialism, external colonialism, very well here. But for Tate, it was another form. You could call it internal colonialism. His generation grew up feeling that they had been colonized by the Scots, that they had been a Danish colony and Norse colony until the 15th century. So they were very much looking in an antagonistic way at the Scots as having taken over the island, and also two waves of clearances. They were very aware of that, his generation, and they were very much digging into their past and into themselves as not British. So he was quite fired up when he arrived, and that's a long story, too long to get into, but
just a few images. Like, here's a landscape, which is way out in the North Sea, that is windswept and no trees. Just some images. This is of Tate in Lerwick as a teenager. And you can see perhaps some of the work that he did here on basketry. It's so much work with women. It was very exciting for me, actually, to read the work of Lynn Abrams, who has written a history of women in Shetland, and that is a fairly new history, and gave me lots of insight into she really felt there was something going on in Shetland that was really gender specific, that wasn't happening on the mainland, and that the women were really running the islands. And Tate, I really felt that his gravitation into the women's world here could easily have been affected by that. They still do lots of knitting, but then the women supported themselves by knitting. And I love this photo because you can see Tate wearing his Shetland attire. So these are just where I've highlighted it. Tate's main base was the southern interior, but he was also, through his guiding work, which comes on later, up in the northern regions, the Stikine and the Cassiar, guiding usually from end of August right until November. They came in close touch with the Tall Tan. So this is just a little, I'm taking us just on a little trip with him here. The red dots are just to give you a sense of a nice old map, and a 19-year-old who comes all the way from Shetland, across the Atlantic, to New York, and then steamer up to Boston, and then transcontinental railway to Tacoma, steamer to Victoria, and then from Victoria to Vancouver, he goes to Port Moody, and at Port Moody, which is then the terminus of the CPR, he ends up on a working train to Yale, and then another working train to Cisco, where they're finishing the bridge. And then from there on, this would have been the working train, sort of. And then from Cisco to Lytton, and Lytton to Spence's Bridge, it was by the wagon road, which was apparently more hair-raising than the working train. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of color. So this is sort of what Lytton would have looked like then. But Spence's Bridge is very important to this book. So this is what Spence's Bridge looked like. Now, Tate ended up behind Spence's Bridge in the Twall Valley, but where he worked at his uncle's trade store down close to the bridge. Murray's own little cottage was in the background there in white. And then there was a little, fairly decent-sized stopping house or hotel beside the trade store. So this was the little hub of Spence's Bridge. Another shot, you can always tell the age of these photos by the Lombardy poplars, apparently. They were planted in 1884. So if I had only one photo to show and I was restricted to one, I would have this up for the whole talk. Because she's really important, Antco. Within 3 years, Tate had aligned himself closely with the Tlacopa community, but he and Antico were living together by 1887, and they married in 1892. And she died in 1899 of pneumonia, which is really a sad thing. He was very broken up, but she was obviously central to his life and central to drawing him into all this work. This is, you can't really see, but I just wanted to give you a sense of just these little dots of reserves up there where I have the blue box on the other side. You can see the long pencil-like reserve was her reserve, and she and Tate managed to preempt a 70-acre piece of land right next to her reserve, so she was able to live really with her community, as he did too. This, you're not going to see the detail, but I just want to show you what's possible with Tate. This is the marriage certificate, and you can see what happens when you've got, church clergymen trying to decipher words. You know, this was so funny to me. Hiawatha was apparently one, I thought there's no name that resembles even closely Hiawatha, other than Hiawatha. And the other one starts with a Q, Quilam Jute. It was just, this is a kind of forensic work you can do with Tate's notes that make you figure out who they are. So anyway, I found out they were her uncle up there, William Kulamashut and Chief Wistaminitsa, her chief. But, you know, how things get confused, you know, if we didn't have tape properly documenting names, who would ever know? So this was this is one of the only interior shots we have of him up there. I say then and now because there's some outbuildings there. We're not quite sure which one was his and Aunt Co's log house, but I just wanted to have a little shot of that. So this was his life on the land. This is where he wanted to be, loved to be, became very adept at, and just was his life from 1884 till he died in 1922. That's always where he wanted to be. So 10 years after being here, I'm back to Franz Boas again, because Boas is also, Boas is doing ethnographic work, but he's from Germany, highly trained mathematician, physicist, who has trying to sort of push himself into a new field of geography, which is, he can sort of morph into anthropology. So he's managed to get himself from Germany to North America, New York City. He's doing contract work, trying to get some sort of a job, ideally in a university or a museum. So he's got contract work out here. So this is about his fourth or fifth contract of, you have to feel sorry for the man. We know how hard it is if you were given a car now as one person to travel around our province and map the indigenous languages and their boundaries and do some other work too, like measure people. Let's come back with as many hundreds of measurements of people as you can get. So he was tasked with this job. It was a very difficult one. He wasn't good at it. He himself says he wasn't good at it. He was more of an introvert, definitely a high-powered academic who preferred his own little sphere to outward spheres. So doing field work like this was hard. And when he landed at Spencer's Bridge at 4 o'clock in the morning in September of 1894, we have this all in his letters, he was ready to give up. People had mocked him at the previous destination for what he was doing. So he got up, and you can imagine, he eyed this, looked at the village by daylight, and thought, oh, no, where am I? This is, like, worse than I even thought. Somebody sent him across the river. The bridge had been washed out. 1894 was a big year for a flood. So he got across the river, went to see the uncle. The uncle said, no, I'm not their guy. You've got to go up the mountain to that Twall Valley. Find him, my nephew. And so he goes up there, and he finds Tate and Aunt Co and her relatives, and he's unbelievably impressed. So he actually runs back down the mountains, gets a suitcase of measuring tools, heads back up, and measures people all night. And we have those measurements. It's bizarre. But fortunately, more than the measurements that's interesting are their names and all their interrelationships. So Boas then and Tate make a deal. The next day, Tate arrives at his hotel, at the bottom of the hotel, still there, the Spencer's Bridge Inn. And off they go on horseback. And Tate, you know, Boas just can't believe this. So by the end of that, he says, I want you to write a report for me. So that became the beginning of a long relationship. He came back in December. Tate already had a couple of hundred pages. And he realized, like, I've got someone here who can really, really work for me. So what it ends up being, and I try to do this in Chapter 5, I want people in Chapter 5 to actually just start out feeling fairly relaxed. By the time you get to the end of Chapter 5, I want you to feel exhausted. Because Boas pushes Tate hard right until his death. Sapir, who's now working in Ottawa in 1910, he also decides he'd like to work with Tate. Tate decides, yes, I'd like to work with Sapir. He'd be a good guy, perhaps a little less pushy. And so he works with Sapir, tries to, and he does. But Boas had this little caveat. Yes, you can work with Sapir as long as you finish your work for me. But as you find out in Chapter 5, Boas never lets him finish. It just keeps him going and going and going. So it is exhausting, but it's an amazing, I call it Paper Mountain because you cannot believe what he produced between 1894 and 1922. Like, this man has beautiful handwriting, and he's just got this incredibly inquisitive mind. He's interested in everything. It makes you wonder about the education he had until age 16, because he knows all of his plants. He knows all of his fish. He knows the Latin names, the English names, wherever he goes. He's noticing, he's documenting, he's drawing, he's sketching. He's just can never stop. I often wonder if maybe it had something to do with that Shetland feeling of loss. You know, you're going back to the 15th century trying to remove yourself from the British imprint, and you can't find it. You find fragments, but the stories are gone, the ones you really want. The place names are all there. There's so much else that's gone. So this is a really a treasure trove for me. Because what you find in the record, you don't find Tate at all, by the way, right? Missing in history completely. If you look at the histories of anthropology, the indices to their histories, you will not find his name. I just read another new one this week. No Tate. No Tate. So now you're starting to see a little bit of George Hunt. Boas, once he had Tate working for him by mail, very convenient, the mail was very fast, at Spencer's Bridge doing his interior work, he had George Hunt, who was Tlingit, and with an English father, Tlingit mother, doing his coastal, central coastal work, and he could write too. So he had the two of them, like, going back and forth. And there's a lot coming out now on Hunt. So it is kind of telling when you look at Boas from 1900 to 1920, he comes once. I think he doesn't really have to. He's got a really good thing happening here with these guys, but neither of them has been given the credit that they deserve. I mean, Hunt is turning up, but Tate, so far, not. Museum curators, yes. We have Judy Thompson did a lovely book, Museum of Canadian History, on Tate's work in the Tall Tan, highlighting his collections. Other than that, we have nothing. So this was really important, and which is why I put this slide up here, because I was so excited. Like, maybe it just looks like an ordinary little piece of data. But the date, 1893, was so important. I jumped out of my seat. This was in New York City. In those days, you had to go to get them. It wasn't online when I was gathering all of this. So this was mixed up in a box of Franz Boas's notes, not Tate's name files. And the fact that it was dated 1893 was so important, because the word out there is that Boas got Tate started, that he was the motivating, well, he was a motivating force, but that Tate became an ethnographer when Boas launched him. So you can see here, this is a wonderful collection of stories with old people, very different style, too, than we're used to with Boas's edited Tate collections. So, and you can see Tate when he didn't have a camera. What do you do? This was Pa'a, old guy, probably about, I think, figured about 75. And there's another guy, Chilligeskut, who's even older, who are reflecting on what they've, stories that they've heard and experienced. What I loved about it, focused on the 19th century, on their own lives. So 1893 was so important because it didn't just all start in 1894. So I spend one chapter, all the end of the chapter, trying to sort of show what Tate did between 1884 and 1894. He was doing a lot of documentation, very, very passionate documentation on why this depopulation, why are people, what happened with the gold rush, that sort of stuff. So that's just a page. So Boas got Tate collecting stories too, and there are hundreds of them published. But Boas was more interested in the generic story. If you had 10 different people telling a story, then you wanted to boil it down to the one. What I love about Tate, and Boas was really interested too in the generic story, so not how individuals tell their stories. So what I loved about this, and what I'm going to do for my last few minutes, is just sort of show you how peopled, and that's what I love doing in the communities. And we have someone here who might end up doing a digital huge project with all this. I hope she lands that project, because there's so much to work with. We need to go through the field notes and put the people back in, because Boas did such a job of removing them And so what you get through the field notes is a real sense of people, of the people behind. These are just showing you the southern groups that he worked with. He also worked with the northern groups, but he also did some work south of the border on these reservations. It just covers a huge geography. But these, you can't see them very well, but these are names. These were compiled before he met Boas, names and names of people. In 1897, Boas turned up with Harlan Smith, who took photographs, and those were published without their names. So it's so great to go back to the community and say, here's Tate's list of their names. He wanted their names recorded, and this is a little boy named Tommy Lick in 1897, and Tommy Lick died just before I arrived in the 19th. He lived to be very old. He was an Indian doctor, a Nisalkapeskut, you can see. He was recorded. He's all recorded in songs. Like, what a great thing to be able to go back and do. Lovely pictures in 1897. No names. There's her name, Kwasinek. I love being able, the beautiful people. This is Kakapitsa. She sang in 1897. These is Kakapitsa's songs. Antko sang, too. And through his notes, these are pre-Boas notes. You can just find Antko. You can find Wistamnitsa, who I had earlier. There's family histories. This is a wonderful narrative family history that turns up in the Okanagan monograph published after Tate's death in kind of point form, very hard to follow. To be able to go back and find the originals like this is really good. More names, because there was also massive collecting, and that's a story in and of itself I don't have time to get into, but I think that actually those women who were making piles of stuff they had never seen and never worn, getting fancier and fancier and fancier. If you made a dress, a plain one, and you got $9 for it, but your neighbor got 14, well, you added some bubbles and fringes. I'd love to see it. I think that it really was the women having fun with the curators. But notes, anyway, masses of collections that are going to come back to the community. There's initiatives away, lots of repatriation, huge amount of stuff, wonderful thought that they're coming back. These are just a sense of the names and the notes. Plants. I would say if there was any life work that we could pin on Tate, it would probably be his ethnobotany. And he collected plants for his entire life, the Latin name, the English name, the Inuit name, the use of the plant. It ended up in a pamphlet-style publication after his death, and I was really happy to see this. His second wife, he remarried in 1904, a French rancher's wife, and they had five kids. But when he died in 1922, his wonderful letter to Boas to say, I was so upset, she said, this was my husband's life work, and it appeared under someone else's name with, you know, little brackets with field notes by Tate. Now, Tate didn't brag, but I found him only, you know, a couple of times with Boas saying, quite later on, you know, I've got 800 of them documented. I know that the top ethnobotanist, Chamberlain at the University of Utah, has gone as far as anybody's gone in ethnobotany, and I think I've gone further. So that needs to be redone. Maps, mapping. And I think this comes from Shetland. It comes from overwriting the colonial maps. They're just masses of maps, all annotated. Constant place names. If you open up his published ethnographies, you'll see pages and pages of place names. I think that's intentional. I mean, overwriting the maps. Songs and stories. I've mentioned that in the notes, for me, it was a treasure trove, and my own early work drew me into all of this. We've got all these wonderful notes, people singing. This is Yopatko. I'm not going to play her singing. It's not enough time, but here she turns up in the basketry monograph. You'll see her again, and with her designs. Here, the problems with this manuscript. Museum collections. You can see who's collecting, what they're getting paid. Accession notes. When I was in Boston just about a month and a half ago and got to see, I had only been there once before and spent my whole time with the notes that Tate had sent in with a big collection he sent in 1915. They said that Tate's collection of 600 items is the best documented collection in their museum, and it's huge. It's the Peabody Boston. He said that we don't have anything that comes close to this. He was just so careful. And again, it might be because trying to retrieve it as Shetlanders through their through their parish registrars, just family histories as much as they could, was hard. And so I often wondered if he was thinking of the future. So I'm going to just conclude with the most important part probably of the book, and it's too bad it always comes at the end, because the land issue was so huge for these chiefs. As far as they were concerned, the colonial project in British Columbia sat on stolen land. None of them could speak English. So to have someone who could translate for them and get their translations in the forms of letters to premiers, letters to prime ministers, letters to the Department of Indian Affairs, and we have D.C. Scott. I made D.C. Scott the subject of Chapter 8, and it was Michael, who my partner over there, who was so helpful through this whole project, picking it all apart, telling me what I needed, where I needed it, said, you have to bring D.C. Scott to life. You have to make him a character. So often in our academic writing, we just drop a name. You know, that's fine, and we can tell everybody what he did. It took me maybe 6 months to turn D.C. Scott into a character. It's a much harder task than anyone will ever know. So anyway, he's my character in Chapter 8, and I really do call him the Darth Vader of Indian Affairs, because he was there from 1913, 1920, 1932. So these guys had them to deal with, but the big McKenna-McBride Royal Commission, which was happening at this time, I liked pairing up the commissioners, with that. So anyway, this was a treasure trove. It took about 20 years, I think, to figure it out. I still don't think I had figured out, and I was really fortunate to have a legal historian, Hamer Foster, who kind of went through it in a very helpful way and kept saying, you know, don't worry, you're not a legal historian, but still I gained an appreciation for what those chiefs had to try to understand in terms of constitutional history and, you know, relationship with Britain, and how do they get this problem aired in the British High Courts, you know, this land title, and the McKenna-McBride had made no space to even, they were not allowed to deal with the land, with sovereignty or title. They had conscription to deal with, which just horrified Tate, and I think that was one of his successful campaigns. The potlatch ban, Tate waded in on that as well. So these documents are really important, and this was the most, I'll end on this one maybe. This is the most important one. Well, maybe not the most important one. They're all important, these documents. But when Tetlanitsa and the chiefs, interior chiefs, were in Ottawa in 1912, 1916, he died in 1918, sadly. They actually got involved with Sapir. I think Sapir, in a nice way, said, you know, like, they're dealing with so much friction in that side of the government, the parliament. Let's bring them into the Victoria Museum, which was at the other end of the Metcalfe Street in Ottawa. Maybe they can relax here. And they did relax. They sang. They did a lot of really neat work. And this is one of the things that came out. In 1916, Tetlanitsa and Tate had a great back-and-forth exchange on traditional land tenure, what that meant to Tetlanitsa in his own terms, without any references to DIA or reserve numbers, or it was just like, how are families organized? How is the land organized? How do people manage the land as a group? It was just it's a beautiful document. And Barbeau was there, Barbeau on the side, being the stenographer. So it's a really, we don't have Tate many documents actually being recorded by somebody else. This is a rare document, and that was Tetlanitsa. And that's a printout of it. So I want people at the end of my book to feel like you have a connection, that these are people, amazing politicians in British Columbia, who, aside from Tate going missing in history, they really have gone missing. I came away from my several decades in this region, and it was so great to be up in Tetlanitsa community. John Tetlanitsa was an amazing person. When he died in 1908, you just get the feeling of Tate, a broken heart. John Wistemnitsa, another really important. You can find them in the McBride Royal Commission hearings, which are transcribed, dealing with difficult conversations about their reserves. And Chilihitsa, another really important chief over from Douglas Lake. Basil David from the Bonaparte Reserve, Shwupam. Also, really, he made two trips to England. These are really important people. Now, I really think this is a Kamloops meeting, and we have someone here tonight who is special, and that's C.M. Tate, Reverend C.M. Charles Tate was also part of this very small cohort. Arthur O'Meara was working closely with Tate, also from Victoria, just nonstop important work. Hamar Foster is doing extremely important work on O'Meara, and C.M. Tate and O'Meara were very much a part of this political campaign. And we have his great-nephew here. Where is he? Yeah, right here. Yes, he's here tonight. So that feels like a very special connection, because C.M. Tate was one of those soldiers who fought pretty hard. So, we have C.M. Tate, and that was a political meeting. And this is just another one, Peter Kelly, Haida, who also worked closely with C.M. Tate and O'Meara. And Tate and Kelly were very much part of the Allied Tribes, the organization that formed in 1916. I like this one. This is 1920. They're all in Ottawa fighting not just the McKenna-McBride final report, which, by the way, was hidden from them for several years while it circulated through governments, finally revealed, and then Tate and Kelly produced this amazing document in 1919. So they're in Ottawa fighting that and another major damaging bill. And look who we've got. Tate on the second row. We've got D.C. Scott looking very Scottish with his briefcase. And we've got Basil David in the front. Mackenzie King, who was the liberal, leader of the opposition, D.C. Scott and Basil David. I'm going to end with this, because I was on our way back from our trip. I said to Byron Sminks, who Michael Liv and I have known forever, who was part of our Stein battle years ago, he was retiring, and he said, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, maybe I need a job in a hardware store. I can't retire. And then this job came up at this unbelievable reconstructed village. That I know a number of people have been there. And Byron, we stopped in and he gave us a complete tour. He's the manager of this, and he's just so knowledgeable. He said, it's the perfect job for me. And I said to Byron, are many people stopping by? And he said, no, it could be the signage. It's not good. We had to go by it and had to go back and find it. Definitely, if you're going up the Fraser Canyon, stop. And if you can, I have his email. See if he's going to be there for sure. And he's such a special person. And he was wandering around. It was just Tate this and Tate that and Tate, all of the structures there are based on designs and write-ups that they're drawing from Tate. So he's pretty much a Tate fan. So, but I thought this was a good way to end. I told Byron I'll do it at every talk. So on that note, and I also want to say I have another special guest, Audrey McClellan, who went through every word as the copy editor of my manuscript came tonight, too. So she's had a good go at my manuscript. It's very special to have her here, too. Thank you. So thank you very much, Peter, and for everybody, all of my friends and all of you who have spent all of this time listening to my story, which I think is a great story about a great man. Hopefully we are going to put this great man on the map. At the moment, I'm having a hard time getting him across the Rockies. So if anybody can think of any way of getting him eastward, just let me know. And we definitely have a few books. Michael's at the back of the room with some books if anybody is interested in actually reading the story. If you do get the book and read the story, I'm saying to everybody, I would love to hear from you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Wendy. That was fantastic. We have 5 minutes for questions. So we'll take questions from the audience. Wendy, I'm going to leave that to you.
Okay.
The key is repeat the question.
Okay.
After you.
Ooh, that's
because
hard.
Because the question, for example, from over here might not be audible. So repeat the question and
we'll
go from there.
Oh,
thank you.
My thing is that I know our museum does an awful lot of gathering of information
the indigenous peoples. And I'm just wondering, I am a singer. I am so interested in hearing their songs. Can you go online? Can you go to the museum?
Yes.
What do you recommend?
Yes, you can. In fact, they've now got, when I went, they were on these big reels that snapped and broke. They had transferred the cylinders to reels and then to cassettes. Now they've actually digitized them. And I wanted one for a radio interview, actually. And the next day, they sent it to me on a little clip with all the information attached. So you can, the Canadian Museum of History, go to their sound archivist. I can give you the information if you want. But yes, you can. Yeah.
That's the Canadian Museum.
It's your museum. It's our museum. And everything went there. And you can, even when you go onto the site, you can see all of Tate's photographs, you can see the artifacts. It's becoming more and more digitized and open. So I don't know how open they are with sharing those songs, but, you know, the one that I wanted to listen to was a lullaby, and they were fine. Just air it on the radio was fine. Yeah, they are fabulous. Yeah, and they're so crystal clear. So, and you've got Tate introducing everyone, which is kind of cool, yeah. Another question. Oh, yes.
When you mentioned how Boaz altered Tate's voice in the writings that he sent him from his field notes, did you get a sense in the pre-1894 material of Tate's voice, and what was that voice?
Yes, that's a very good question. You know, about how did Boaz edit, and what did he do with voice, and how does it differ from Tate's? You just have to look at the 1893 collection of stories. They're first-person stories with lots of color and dialogue, and they've got a name attached. What Boaz does when you read them, they're very summarized and they're third-person accounts, very dry, very dull. It's just a pity. So in the notes, you've definitely got more of a sense of just sitting with the person, writing down the story as the story is being told. With Boaz, it is much more taking five or six, and he will tell you often in a footnote that they've been boiled down to one. And the text itself of the monographs is, you know, Boaz was at heart a scientist, and he was, to be fair to him, there was so much bad stuff being written with so much subjective bias, people laying on trips, that he did sort of want to remove that and get more into a third-person authoritative kind of general account, almost to make it look more legitimate and scientific and to separate from the earlier stuff. But the fortunate thing is in the field notes, you can find the excitement. You can find the dynamism of the exchange. And certainly in Ottawa, it's really great because we have Barbeau on the side recording a lot of stuff between Tate and these chiefs on the spot. And you just can't see what, you just can't read the game with Barbeau. You won't believe what he did when he published them. You know, he completely rewrote them, but we do have the originals, and the originals are magic. So yes, there is a big difference. Yeah, good. That's a good question. I try to deal with that in chapter 10 in a way, because I think Boaz missed some really interesting plays on stories about whites, that Boaz was also interested in the deep past, pushing stuff into the past, more past tense. If you read Tate, and I think this still is retained in the ethnographies, you've got past and present. Pay attention, I say in my book, pay attention to how Tate's using past tense and present tense. Because he's very reluctant to push these people into the past. So they're very much a living part of the present, and that is very unusual for 1900. So what I try to do, I guess, in this book is try to sort of show, especially in chapter 6, how to read those monographs and what to look for, where to find the field notes. All of the citations back at the back of the book will lead community members to how to find that stuff. Yeah, but that's a really important question, a driving question for me. Yes?
You mentioned earlier that there are some plans to try and collect Tate's original materials and make them publicly available. Is that...
Well, they are. I mean, they're becoming more. I mean, the work I had to put into going to get them before the age of digitization was crazy. But now you can go to the American Museum of you can go to the American Philosophical Society, where the mother lode is in Philadelphia, where all of Boas' papers got dumped. And they are in the process of digitizing Tate's right now. But they have digitized the letters. So the letters are just huge. Like, they fill four major huge binders for me. Those are publicly available, and I can actually give you the name of it. My email is wickwire@uvic.ca, and I can actually send you to the curator, who will then probably give you a link to get to them, because those letters are all available. So you can find there all of Tate's correspondence with Boas. And in Ottawa, I'm not sure how much they've digitized of that, but all of Tate's correspondence with Sapir, like, that's a gold mine because it covers so many years. And then they're in the process in Philadelphia of digitizing all the field notes. I'm not sure where the American Museum of Natural History is, but gradually that stuff is all coming to the fore. You can see in my citations, if you're looking for a document, go. I hope it's the right date, right page. You should be able to go to it and see where it is. And then if you have the name of the curator, you can see who I think, the curator, you could go find it. Yeah. But hopefully the communities are going to be making it more and more available to, they're really on this. Angie Bain, some of us know, who's UBC, works for UBCIC, has been, she's really into the collections and trying to find out where they are getting repatriation going. But mostly you can go on to museums now. I know you can go on to the American Museum of Natural History and find all the artifacts. And and if you go to any of these cities, go see them, and they will pull them out, or you can go see them on display. Do we have time for one more question?
We have 1 minute for one question.
Yes.
There's one here.
Yes.
When I was reading your book, there's sort of the leitmotif of the negative impacts of the white colonizers on the First Nations, and in particular how it comes into the coyote stories, and addiction comes up. But when you sum up Tate's sort of life experience and why he might still be in obscurity, you mentioned his addiction to the area around Spence's Bridge, and that was a word that really jumped out.
Addiction.
Addiction for me. Like, addiction to the land and being...
attraction, like the... Yeah.
And it really jumped out for me, and I was wondering if you could comment on that choice and sort of his... your take on his legacy and, like, being tied so specifically to Spence's Bridge?
I think that's a good question. You know, Tate tied so specifically to Spence's Bridge and how that affects things. I think that's a really good question, and it does affect. And as I was going around from Merritt to Ashcroft to Lytton to Spence's Bridge, I actually felt a little bit of pangs of kind of like, ooh, really Spence's Bridge is the sort of main, that's where he lived, and everybody around there participated in everything all the time. So, you know, when he went over and did his trips in the Shuswap, and those were shorter trips. And I even feel like the Nicola Valley and down to Similkameen are shorter, so it's not going to be as rich. So I feel in a certain sense, even when I'm in those communities, that, you know, the center of gravity is Spence's Bridge. And I don't want to tell those other communities that, really, but... they are lucky. They are really all of... But then they're so interrelated. Like, Nicola Valley isn't that far, and he was over there doing stuff. You can relate to that. And he was down in the Similkameen, and we know what he was doing there. Now, he was down in the States. I don't cover that much. That's a whole interesting thing, too. Those trips into the States, and I feel badly for Tate, because Boas published those after his death, and he made sort of a few comments that I wouldn't have made in the prefaces, because Tate wasn't alive. But Tate wouldn't have wanted those published. So they weren't finished. And, you know, he was constantly saying, we can't do this. We can't finish this project. It needs a lot more work. So those were quick trips, too. So I feel for those studies, too. Tate wasn't part of getting those out. The basketry monograph was published after his death. But it's a really good question. It is Spence's Bridge. If you were able to sort of do a kind of a map... I think, you know, one of those maps, you'd have to have a real center point at Spence's Bridge, and then everything's out from there. They are so lucky. But it's so funny, all my life I've been working on the South Central Interior, and all my courses and everything on Indigenous history in British Columbia, I also always felt like it's going to take me a lifetime to get a handle on this, because I was dealing with Tate. And, you know, even people, students ask stuff about the coast, I think, I haven't got there yet. I mean, I don't think I'll ever get there. And even when I get to the central part of the province in the north, although he did a fair bit on the Taltan, you know, I just felt like I could never get a handle on it because I could never get to the bottom of his notes. I could never get to the bottom. And I don't think he was a humble person. I don't think he ever wrote in a way that he felt, you feel when you're reading him that you're writing down, you're reading the authority. That's also what I really like. It's very much that he's kind of this, in a very humble, beautiful way, kind of trying to document as honestly and respectfully as he can, butting up against a lot of the racist, you know, Victorian Edwardian stuff that he's dealing with. So he really is a new bright light on the scene. That's why, I mean, we have to get him across the Rockies. I mean, if anybody has any help, it's really hard with a little academic press to get airing, you know. You just, the big ones are out there, and, you know, this guy has to get out there. I really do think, and once we get him out there, then people can sort of see, like, that's why and it was, I think, the parting thing that I felt at the Indigenous gatherings in the interior 10 days ago, the best thing was, you know, they really, really embraced this book. They embraced Tate. They thanked Tate. And then the interesting thing was someone wanted me to report, but what, and because there was, at the Spencer's Bridge gathering, there were no white people. There were a few at the Lytton. And so one of the Indigenous people at the Lytton said, she said, I want to know what white people think of this book. Because they really sort of feel that white people are going to be really mad at it or really upset about it or something. But, you know, so it's I do want to prove that's wrong, you know. And I do think there's a message here that we don't have in Canada very much. And that's someone who really dove in with a huge pile of respect. So at a very unusual time. So thank you. Thank you for being such good listeners.